trip to Arizona and Mexico. This is my lovely team that I went with, college students and then two other leaders. A name that you might want to be pointed out to you is this is Jensen Miller, who we all know.
I thought so.
It was really cool actually to get to have Austin's kiddo on my trip. That was fun, and we definitely I made fun of him a little bit for it, and it was a good time. So yeah, so I have just a bunch of honestly like random notes. Things I'm trying to remember, things that stood out even to students. We've done some presentations, so I'm trying to pick a bit from there as well. So I'll just slowly talk and try to remember what my notes are. And yeah, we spent most of our time in Tucson, which is why we're in front of the Tucson sign there from downtown. We actually spent about half of our time in Tucson and half of our time in Douglas, Arizona, and Agua Prieta, Mexico. There's actually, I have a little plug for MCC at the end of this. There is actually a learning tour that's going to be happening in May. If you would like to go literally on the exact thing I am going to be presenting on for the most part, there is an opportunity at the end of May if you would like to do that with the exact organization that I did. So a little plug in case you'd be interested. But this is our team, and so how I would describe this week would be we were in Tucson, we learned a ton of things that made our minds kind of like jumbled, introduced us to a lot of different moving pieces of whatever like the wall, borderlands, immigration, whatever you want to name it, like whatever is the most helpful. We really just looked at all of the moving parts because it isn't just like Border Patrol affected or immigrants coming across that are affected. It's the border cities whose economic status is not as good now that there is a huge 40-foot wall, or it's probably higher than 40-foot wall in the middle of like the city that they used to work with. There's the detention, there's so many moving parts. And so we tried to look at as many people that are affected by this situation as possible to try to get like a full picture of what this means. So that's how I would describe this to you before I settle into kind of the smaller pieces of it. So, because I like to go big and then little. So the next slide, Ty just found out that he's doing this. So one of the first things, this is Jensen again, as a great American leader. I know, right, of course, of all people. So one of the first things we learned about was NAFTA. It's a huge piece of the puzzle in terms of why Mexico and America are in the relationship that they are, what our economic status and what their economic status is like. In 1994, I believe 1993, 1994, we signed NAFTA with Canada, America, and Mexico, and it determined what everyone paid for wherever all of our goods were going. And in order for it to work, Mexico had to agree to do certain things that were more similar to how America wanted them to do it. And then that trickled down to kind of where we find ourselves today. That's a huge piece that they said we needed to learn to understand why is Mexico kind of in an economic situation that they are. So that was pretty helpful. Next. So it was like the first full day that we were there. They just threw us in the deep end, and we did a pilgrimage, pretty much. So this is Arizona that you're looking at right now, and we are walking an exact trail that the Samaritans, is what the organization is called. It's a nonprofit organization that leaves food and water on known trails where migrants walk, knowing that they mostly go through the desert, and we'll talk about that in a second, why they do. But since most migrants go through the desert, a large number of them pass away because of dehydration. I mean, you can imagine what the desert offers you. Dehydration, exposure, no food or water. Usually it takes them several days to get to the wall from where they are. They cross the wall, and then it's several days. It's like 100 miles or more to get to Tucson. So it'll take them about 6 days of walking just to find whatever the biggest city is from where they cross. So think about how much water you would need in the desert. Probably for about 2 weeks is about what they think those people are within the desert space. If you want to go to the next one, I just have several pictures. this is us sending out water. So we did the actual pilgrimage with the Samaritan organization. You can see how it's rocky, you know, just a way to see like the terrain, what desert kind of is in the Sonora Desert, if that's interesting. This is what the actual wall looks like in this area. So many of us think of the wall that's in the news. It's very large, it's orange, and it's like big and lots of things. You'll see a picture later. But obviously, it's not that way the whole way because that's extremely expensive, though that is something that is being offered right now to the Senate to be able to pay that $5 billion. It would pay for the wall to go all the way. But they mostly just put walls up in cities. In about 1995 was when the walls first started going up. That's like the Clinton era, if that's helpful, who was making those decisions. And the wall started coming in conversation, and the word deterrent was used to describe why we decided to put a wall up. The decision was, there was a lot of crossing in the 90s and the early 2000s, so they said, if we put up a wall in the cities, which is what we'll see in a second, if we put up a wall in the cities, it's a deterrent. They are probably not going to want to jump this crazy wall, as you'll see. What it will help them decide is, and if we put cameras everywhere and people with guns and stuff, what they'll have to do is they'll have to go to the desert, and we know that they won't survive. So it's the idea of deterrence. It's in our paperwork when you look in like 1995, what they were deciding, why they were deciding to put a wall. They were saying, let's put them in the cities where it would be the easiest for them to, you know, kind of hide and like be across and get working and things like that. Let's put the walls there. They'll have to go around, and we know the percentage will go down in terms of who will actually survive to make it around. So that is what are the actual paperwork in terms of why they decided for a wall and where they put the wall. So in Arizona, it's just a barbed wire fence. It's just an old cow fence, pretty much, for the farmers in the room. So when we walked the pilgrimage, we walked to the wall, and the students were like, oh, this is what we see. And so we put water down and food down. There was a lot of examples that immigrants had just been crossing. There's wrappers everywhere, and we saw footprints and things like that. And so we prayed in that space as well, and then we walked out. It was an incredibly long walk for our very, like, bougie selves who, you know, like, we had just come off an airplane and we thought this was, like, the worst thing that could ever happen to us. And we have water and food waiting for us, you know, at the end. And so it was a very, like, physical body experience to connect students to say, this is physically what it feels like, and this is only half, or barely half, of what they're experiencing. So it was cool to be able to, like, get our bodies working, get students really, like, plugged in. So when we were on the pilgrimage, they talked to us about, you are in the exact place in which people walk. You are, like, there are footsteps. We are walking in the steps of other migrants with us. So we're sitting in the desert, and the Samaritan organization leader, he pulled out this map, and he said, you know, I would say, I believe Douglas is, like, maybe around here. So with Tucson, we probably were like in this region, right smack in the middle. And so he gave us this, and he said, this is a map of so far the bodies that have been found from 2007, I believe. The remains that have been found in the desert, in which while we are sitting there. So if you can, if that's helpful for you to know, like, we are sitting there, we're handed this map in a very, you know, they tailored it in a very good way as we're talking and we're trying to process, you know, like, where we are. And them saying they partner with a medical examiner in the area of Tucson.
Can you show what order is in your picture?
Just so I mean, yeah, so this is the American side because it's the American Medical Examiner, so they're not showing the Mexico side because it's not their organization. So this would be with the American Examiners that work in Tucson. They're the ones that are called when a remain is found. And so this is the map that they show so far of people that have passed away. So once again, when I say the word deterrent and why that is like the idea of what we're planning when we put the wall in a certain place and not in other places, is it's because the walls would be like where there's a few less people, a few less people, and they're hoping they go out and around. As you can see, that's all desert area. So, yeah. Go on, I think. Okay, so so if we can move, kind of move on from that. So another thing that we talked about was we talked about the sanctuary movement. Has anyone, in Columbus, actually Columbus Mennonite is a sanctuary church, and is that right now actually housing a woman who has been ordered to be deported. I believe she has 2 or 3 children. And so Columbus Mennonite has said, we will become a sanctuary church and we will house her because ICE, like Border Patrol and ICE, they are actually not allowed to go into churches or they have like an unsaid agreement that they will not go into churches and take people to be deported. So we actually got to meet people who started the sanctuary movement. It was started in Tucson in the 80s. Really quick lesson, in like the 50s, 60s, and then all the way through the 80s, there was civil war throughout Central America. Some of us have heard of different ones. And unfortunately, America did sponsor many of those civil wars. I'm thinking Guatemala. I was in Guatemala, and so we learned about how through the Banana Republic and our CIA, we actually put money towards deciding what side of the civil war we would help. Etc. So as we're like participating in this crazy civil war that's happening, tons of crossing, especially in the 70s and 80s, to America from Central America, which is where most of our migrants are passing from now. Most of them are not from Mexico, they're from Central America. So in the 80s, a church in Tucson, a Presbyterian church, decided that they were going to participate and say, if we believe in radical hospitality, and if we believe that humanity comes before rules and laws, then we are going to start a sanctuary movement. And so their church became a safe space where people could stay, and ICE agreed they would not come into. And then they would work with those people to get their paperwork or whatever was necessary, work with ICE to get whatever paperwork was needed in order to get them cleared so that they could go to America and maybe have a green card, maybe have a working visa, whatever they were hoping to have. Or to get them asylum, which is when you hear about the caravans, the famous caravans, you know, that are being talked about. Most of those people are asking for asylum. So that would be they are wanting to show proof that it is no longer safe for them to be in the country of their origin, their home country. They have to prove that they would be killed if they go back. They have to have actual evidence of that. And then they can ask for asylum, which according to like 1975, I believe, we signed an asylum agreement in America that we would house anyone asking for asylum as long as they went through our paperwork. So we actually, as a country, and it's like part of the Geneva Code and stuff as well, that we're like expected to house asylum people as long as they're able to show I will be killed if I go back. So we got to meet with this church. It was so cool, this idea of radical hospitality and what they chose to say. We believe in this idea that if the church is stepping up for this great need, this is how we can do it. We learned about sanctuary cities, like Denver is considered a sanctuary city. So if you are undocumented, people will not ask for your paperwork. They will hire you within, you know, stipulations, as normal hiring is. Yeah, so there's all different kinds, and that was very popular in the 80s, and these men were, some of them might not be men, so. Next, we learned about detention centers. This was a pretty heavy day. So this is a map of detention centers in America, and I do not believe all of them are privately owned. I do know that a large percent, so I would say over majority, of our detention centers, which is where people who are seeking asylum or people who have been picked up by ICE who are undocumented, they are taken to these places. So they're detention centers, they're a lot like jails. Actually, some of our jails near here, I actually think that the Alliance one, there's one on the way to Louisville. There's a jail on the way to Louisville on the system. Okay, it is considered possibly as open to taking undocumented people, I believe, but none right now. But in Youngstown, there's a large privately owned detention center. So when I say privately owned, that means that there's someone with a decent amount of money who has opened this detention center, and every time a bed is full, they are given money. So our tax dollars are going to building these and to continuing to keep people in these beds, and they do have bed quotas. So that means they need beds to be full at all times, so a lot of times they will keep people there or they will add people because they really need those beds to be full in order for our tax dollars to work and in order for them to get extra money. It is helpful. Many people who own ICE detention centers also pay for super PACs, which are given to the people that we vote for on all levels. That is a bipartisan statement for sure. Big super PACs are paid for largely by ICE detention center owners. So we are participants in this ongoing, circular, very tricky conversation. Next, I don't know what's next. Okay. So then we finally get to Mexico. We've learned all these like mind-boggling things, our participation, all of these pieces, and then we finally get to Mexico. I had never seen the wall before I went when I did my Denver door year, for those who know when we did the door year. On the left is the picture when we were there, so that would have been 2014 or 15. Okay, when I went with my Denver year, this was the picture that I took on the left. As you can see, there's handprints from those who had jumped right before. There's little dirt handprints. And then on the right is a picture that I took when I was there this year. And as you can see, it's changed a little bit. So it has military-grade barbed wire. They use another word for it.
Razor wire?
Yeah, maybe razor wire. So that goes... actually, can you go to the next one? I actually believe there's a... Yeah, so if this is helpful, so this is like a person that's my size. It's one of our students. So as you can see, about shoulder length, it's fine, and there's nothing there, but then it goes all the way to the top. There's four layers. And that's obviously, again, a deterrent, many versions of deterrents, to not have people cross if they do. Obviously, they become incredibly injured. This is the American side of the law. That's also another interesting thing to know. In a second, not yet, but in a second you'll see what the Mexican side of the law looks like. It looks slightly different. But as you can see, it's dirt. There's actually, you might not see in this picture, but there's a Border Patrol truck right here. And he was talking to our leader because he was not super excited about us being there. But he has a good working relationship with Mark, who is the organization leader that does this tour. They have a really good relationship. We're really trying to communicate well and partner and try to... Mark is this beautiful person who just enacts, like, grace. When he... his wife is someone who came over undocumented. He works with lots of people that are, and he also knows, like, the first names of all the Border Patrol. This might also be a compliment. One of the leaders that went with us, Mel Scott, who's my boss, she has met Darren on several occasions, and after about 5 minutes of meeting Mark, she said, you know what, he's literally Darren, but in Arizona, because he just, you know that persona of, like, I'm just here, I'm serving, I know the first names of the Border Patrol, and I know the names of the people who just crossed last night. You know, like, he is that grace, he's that bridge, and it was so wonderful for the students to get to meet someone like that. That was really cool. Back to the harshness of the wall, but so that's what it looks like on the American side. Can you go? So this is a really good picture to be able to see the expanse. As you can see, the normal wall in which you just saw is here. The city is here. You can kind of see how the dirt kind of goes out as it's the city. And then as you can see, this is desert. So we're good. We're about 3 miles from the city now. And see how the wall changes. So once again, it's like that idea of how what the wall is for and what we're hoping it does. And the more that it goes out, that's when it eventually turns to barbed wire, etc. So this is the expanse of what Douglas and Agua Prieta, so Douglas right, Agua Prieta left. And this is what it looks like on the side. So, and then the Mexico side. It's slightly different. As you can see on this side, you can see the barbed wire a little bit. But on the Mexico side, I mean, they have slightly different feelings about what the wall means for them, because it is for them. You know, when you are in the city and you're in Mexico and you look at a wall that was not decided by your country but by another country to be put up and you're looking at this, it means something a little bit different than when the Americans look at it. It's two different conversations, two different narratives. So the Mexico side, as you can see on the right, there's a little bit of sidewalk right there. So they actually, it's this like beautiful subversion. They've made it into a walking park. So there's a sidewalk, and you know, in McKinley Park, how there's that exercise equipment that like is weird, but it kind of works. They have that all along the way. So it is a community space, and so there's seating in different areas. There's like a fountain. They have decided if it's going to be here, and it was not our decision. It's for us. Like they built it because of us. We're going to subversely say we're going to do something else with this. And so as you can see, there's paintings and there's butterflies. A few months before we actually had been there, they decided to do this big community engagement, which I think I do have a picture of later, in which they had all these artists and say, when you think of Mexico and the wall and America and all these relationships together, what do you think of? And so all these people did art on the Mexico side. Obviously, they're not allowed on the American side. But on the Mexico side, so as you walk, especially right before you go to cross into America, several like 100 feet is all artwork just like this, which is it's very jarring how different the sides of those are. Next picture, yes, another picture, Amor sin fronteras, which means love without borders. This is a picture of another community engagement that they did. So the right side is Mexico, left side America, as you can see by the flags, which almost feels ironic at that point, which are right there within the picture. They did a community engagement where they had a concert, I believe for like 24 hours, they had an ongoing concert with dancing, and that's kind of where some of the artwork happened. And they said this very like visceral moment happened in which, in order to set up the stage so that the concert could happen together, sound equipment had to be plugged in through the wall. And it was this very, like, visceral reaction of, we literally need each other in order for this concert to happen. Let's plug in together. Let's show them how much this wall does not mean anything to us. It does not separate us. So that is, like, this very beautiful, a way that the community is deciding to rewrite the narrative a little bit. And the person who did the artwork, the husband of the person that did the artwork is now the mayor of Douglas, and so it's very intentional about the narratives that and the things that he's working on. So, another example, the woman on the left was actually one of our tour guides throughout the week, Elizabeth, we really liked, and so this is another, she went down for the concert and different things, and so that was a little protest that they did there. On the right, I wanted to make sure to show is an after-school program. Who would have thought? We're really connected with those, aren't we? And this is actually a Mennonite after-school program. So it had like Mennonito on the little sign, so I made sure I knew what that word was. Actually, this is David right there, and he is from Colombia. Him and his wife, who's the woman in the red right there, they are Mennonite from Colombia, and they have come up there in doing their 3-year stint through MCC, just like many of us have done. And so he's working with them and he is applying for another position because he is so well liked there. So I thought I'd flash that up because I thought that was interesting. The Mennonites really like after school programs. On the left, so when we're in Mexico, a lot of the conversation that we're having is we're partnering with our churches and organizations in America. We are caring for the people on our side as well. We're working through immigration reform. But another thing we're doing is we're just recognizing the economic situation that we are in here in Mexico. The migrants are crossing to America because they desperately need work, or they're trying to run away from danger. How can we create a situation in which they do not need to cross? Because when you do interview most migrants who are over here, their plan is most of them don't believe that they will be here for more than 3 to 5 years. The assumption is, I need to make a sum of money in order to send back. How do I find that job? And then how do I get back? Since most of their family, when you ask, usually most of their family is still back in the country that they grew up in. How do we create jobs so they do not need to cross? So Café Justo is one of them, and it was very exciting. We actually saw them when we were in Denver, and they were just in a little garage, and they have this crazy vision. Again, I was so reminded of Lighthouse, just like these insane visions, and they all came to fruition. Now it's a coffee shop, not a garage. And what Café Justo does is they went back to Chiapas, which is one of the, in Mexico, there's like different states or different like areas, there's several. And so Chiapas is one down south. It is like known for the violence of the drug cartel, and it's known for its civil wars that have happened. Most people have heard of Chiapas. And so these people, it was started by someone who had immigrated up. He was from Chiapas. He had a conversation with Mark, and he said, no one in my village has a job. Like, we're not sure what to do. The coffee industry has come in. Good old Starbucks, good old Folgers has come in, and we are not being paid for the work that we're doing with our coffee beans. But we need a solution. And so in conversation, they went back to the village, Mark and this man, and they worked with this village in Chiapas. And so it's like Fair Trade Plus is kind of how they described it. So they allowed the village to decide how much money the coffee would be and how much they should get paid. They decided on the name of the product. They decide what the bags look like. They have decision making in all aspects of this business. It is owned by the villagers, not by the by the organization in Mexico. It is owned by the villagers, and they have like not in stocks, but you know they have like money in the business. And so all of their coffee, then they've been trained how to roast it, and so they are working in every aspect of the coffee, even through the delivery up until Mexico, and then if it goes past to America, which is where most of the coffee is taken, because we have a problem with coffee, up until they have their hands in every aspect of that business. So that's why they call it Fair Trade Plus. And so it was an example of how do we think creatively? How can we let ownership happen here for these Mexican people? How do we believe in jobs and we believe in Mexico to create a new space, to have these new visions? Also on the right is Dugla Prieta Works, and it's a house where women in this neighborhood, it's a place where they can go to make money. So they make the bag that I brought was made by them, and have they all, if they sign up, can have like a neighborhood garden, and so they can make vegetables for their family, and there's several different ways that they can be engaged with work in order to create a little bit more funds for their family. This is a ceremony, and it's kind of going back to the migration conversation. This is a ceremony that we participated in that every Tuesday Frontera does, in which anyone who has passed away in the sort of the region that they are in, at least in the desert area where they are, anyone who has passed away that they know of, they write their name on the cross. And then anytime groups or local churches, want to participate, we go through, and all the way through, you can't really see, but this is the wall right here. So it's all the way through to the port of entry, is what that area is called, all the way to the port of entry. We have crosses with the names on them. We yell out the name. And then we say present, and then we pray over those crosses at the end. So it's, again, this very, like, getting our bodies and getting almost a pilgrimage idea of saying, we know that these people pass away. We are participants in this. We are responsible for them as Christians. These are our brothers and sisters, since we're so close with Mexico. How do we honor, ongoing honor for them? And some of them do not have names, and so we recognize that as well. So that's a way that they're participating and saying, this is what's happening in our area. We're recognizing that, and we're honoring those people. This is another way that we saw people recognize and honor. I believe Altero is maybe on the right. So we met this artist who's in Tucson, and he was actually from Central America as well. And a way that he's participating in recognizing this and honoring and in working really in his form of activism is he creates these crosses. Judy's on the left, and she's actually a nun in Douglas who has started doing it in her area as well, which is very cool to see how it's growing. But he makes these crosses, and then he puts them where people have passed away within the desert. So every Tuesday, he'll go out in one of these spaces. He has done like maybe 2,000 or something like that, but he still has a decent amount, obviously, to go. But he goes out. Can you actually go back? Do you know how to go back? And then if they found anything in the area or other places where he's found stuff, he puts it on the cross as well. So that is a can that was found like in the desert near a place where a body was found. So he tries to, put that on the cross as well. This is the Bordia Lands tour, as I said. So if you would like to participate or if you're interested in any more of this, this is what, this is when it is. You can go to the MCC website, of course. And that's pretty much, those are the main points of things that stood out during my trip, I guess. That's it. I don't know how to end, so I'll end that.
Well, thanks, Anne. Well, that was a really timely presentation because, so for those that aren't familiar with the church and how our church relates to denomination, so we're part of Ohio Conference, which is how we relate to our denomination of Mennonite Church USA. So what was it? First week of March, Ohio Conference had their annual conference assembly. And during our annual conference assembly, we passed a resolution on immigration. And so these are moments where I'm like really grateful to be part of a bigger body like conference or Mennonite Church USA, because we're able to say something bigger with a lot more people than just as a church we can. So conference had put together a resource team, and they spent a lot of time reading, a lot of time talking, a lot of time praying, and putting together a resolution of basically like, what do we as a conference say about immigration? And so that was presented to the delegates and was passed. So we have some copies of that here. So we're going to go ahead and pass that out. And I wanted to take just a moment to read this because we were processing, like, how do we take this back to our church and talk about it? And then Anne was coming back from her trip, and we were like, oh, well, isn't that awesome? That would be a great time to do that. So we have some resolutions that we're passing out.
That's the whole packet.
We'll get those passed out. And then I want to take a moment just to read through that, and then also highlight some of the resources that that resource team put together for us that are part of Ohio Conference. You good? All right. So, resolution on immigration. Now, the background. As we consider the multifaceted and complex issue of immigration, we wish to discern and follow the guidance of Scripture and the Holy Spirit. As the body of Christ, we are called to offer a particular witness to the world, including the government. It is for the sake of the body, its witnesses, and for the unity for which it must strive that we offer this resolution. The purpose of this resolution is not to convince, to draw dividing lines, nor to solidify political affiliations. This resolution is meant as an invitation to this part of the church, Ohio Mennonite Conference, to work at finding a third way, rooted in the good news of Jesus Christ, on an issue that divides the culture around us. This is an opportunity to ask ourselves how we will be distinct from the hatred and polarization that surrounds us. This is an opportunity to ask how Christ holds us together and calls us to extend his kingdom. We believe that any discussion of immigration should include, at a minimum, these truths. Human beings as created in God's image. The biblical call to compassion and just treatment of foreigners. The specific teachings of Jesus. And the worldwide nature of the body of Christ. Our confession of faith states that the church knows no geographical boundaries and needs no violence for its protection. While scripture commands us to respect and pray for those in authority, it also calls us to give our ultimate allegiance to Jesus Christ as Lord above any human authority. You can see a list of scriptures there to reference as well. So the resolution then is this. At the individual component, as delegates to Ohio Mennonite Conference, we commit ourselves to become better informed on the issues surrounding immigration with a willingness to consider a variety of perspectives. Regardless of our own national origin, we will seek to reach out and build relationships with our neighbors rooted in Christ's love and compassion. Now, the congregational component. As members of Ohio Mennonite Conference congregations, we will encourage our churches to become better informed on immigration issues, so thank you, Anne. To promote healthy dialogue in group settings, again, thank you, Anne. And to pray for the Spirit's leading and seeking to minister to the needs of immigrants within our community or within our congregation and communities. We call on the church to take the risks involved in obeying Christ's call to welcome the stranger. We recognize the benefits of doing so, such as the richness of multicultural diversity, the revitalization of our congregations, and the opportunities for missional outreach. We will seek to understand the underlying causes of immigration and consider how we might help improve economic and humanitarian conditions in countries of origin in order to reduce the pressures to immigrate. In addition, we will encourage our churches and individual members to contact their elected officials at local, state, and national levels to express our views on immigration. So this was passed at ACA, and so, like I said, this is a chance for us as a congregation to enter into this resolution and present it. Conference put together a packet of resources, and so I printed some of those out. We have some hard copies. I only printed out 5 of them because it's a lot of paper, but I saved the digital copy, and I'd be more than happy to email that out this week. You can see that there is a letter for individuals to send to elected officials. And this is interesting. Somebody mentioned that representatives don't necessarily care about the weight of an organization that sends it. They care about, like, the mass. And so they said Ohio Conference could send one letter, or if 66,000 members of Ohio Conference sent a letter, that would end up being, like, several foot stack, and that would say something. And so there's a form letter in there that you can look at, as well as a list of representatives. There's definitions, there's news, there's a story about Columbus Mennonite that Anne referenced. There's organizations and movements working with that, websites, films, books, prayer guides, podcasts that Ohio Conference has done. And again, you can find all of that at ohiomennoniteconference.org, and I'll send that out as well. One additional component of that, so we kind of had this organic thing of Anne coming back to share and talking about the resolution, but Mickey also read about the resolution in the Evangel, which is our newsletter for conference, and she said, hey, I'd like to talk about that. So we are in the works of figuring out when and where she'll be doing that, but she wants to lead a discussion talking about immigration as well. I think she had an article that she had read that seemed pretty informed that could generate that. Out of that, then, you'll see in the packet that there is an attachment as a letter for congregations to send in. So if you are interested in our congregation sending a letter, I think the way that we're going to do that is that will come from Mickey's group that she's wanting to lead. And if people want to put together a presentation to bring to the church for us to vote on, I think that's how we would do that. And then from there, we would go ahead and send a letter to our representatives on behalf of First Mennonite of Canton. So, that was a lot. Any questions on any of that? Like I said, it's moments like these that I'm really, really grateful to be part of Ohio Conference and Mennonite Church USA. Again, because as a church, we're only able to carry so much power with our voice, but I think it's what a special thing that an entire conference covering Ohio is able to say, like, hey, this is where we stand on immigration, and we're committing to learn more and committing to love our neighbor as Jesus calls us to. So, like I said, there's a few more hard copies up here. I'll email out a digital copy as well, and just continue to encourage you to have conversations with people like Anne who have experience with this, and learn from their experiences. So, thank you.
Thank you, Anne.